After Chawe had gone, Daniel and Chetty Singh confronted each other in silence. Daniel was looking for some sign of weakness or indecision. The Sikh was calm and contained, the shotgun steady in his hands. "My arm is badly hurt," Daniel said at last. "My sincere commiseration, my dear doctor. There is danger of infection." "No," Chetty Singh smiled. "You will be dead before infection can manifest itself."
"You intend killing me?"
"That is an amazingly facetious question, doctor. What alternative do I have? You have been clever enough to discover my little secret. As I have often concluded, too much knowledge is a terminal disease."
"If I'm going to die, why don't you satisfy my curiosity and tell me about Chiwewe? Who proposed the raid, you or Ning Cheng Gong?"
"Alas, dear sir, I know nothing of Chiwewe or this other fellow. Besides, I do not feel in a talkative frame of mind."
"You have nothing to lose by telling me. Who owns the Lucky Dragon Investment Company?"
"I am afraid, doctor, that you will have to take your curiosity to the grave with you."
They heard the land cruiser coming, and Chetty Singh stirred. "That did not take Chawe long. You could not have been at many pains to conceal your vehicle. Let us go to the main door to greet him.
Will you lead the way, please, doctor, and bear in mind that Mr. Purdy's excellent firearm is only a foot from your spinal column."
Still nursing his injured arm, Daniel set off towards the warehouse doors. As they emerged from the aisle between the rows of packing cases, he saw a green Cadillac parked beside the empty railway truck. Probably Chetty Singh had remained safely in the Cadillac until the leopard had returned to its cage. Daniel remembered the shed at the back of the building and the foul animal smell that he had noticed earlier. He was piecing it all together, working out where the leopard was kept and how it was controlled. Even so, it was clear that neither Chetty Singh nor his henchmen trusted the animal. On the contrary, they had been extremely nervous when the leopard was loose. When they reached the main doors, Chetty Singh motioned Daniel to a standstill. Then, abruptly, the heavy door began to roll aside, revealing Daniel's Toyota parked facing the entrance with its headlights burning. Chawe was standing at the external control box of the electrically operated door. When the door was fully opened, he withdrew his key card from the lock of the control box. It was on a short key chain, and he dropped it into his hip pocket.
"Everything is ready," he told Chetty Singh.
"You know what to do," Chetty Singh replied. "I don't want any birds to fly back to settle on my roof. Make sure you leave no sign. It must be an accident. A nice simple accident on the mountain road. You understand that?"
They were speaking Angoni again, secure in the belief that Daniel could not understand.
"There will be an accident," Chawe agreed, "and perhaps a little fire."
Chetty Singh turned his attention back to Daniel.
"Now, dear sir, kindly mount to the controls of your automobile. Chawe will tell you where to go. Please obey him most faithfully. He shoots very well with the shotgun."
Obediently, Daniel climbed up into the cab of the Land Cruiser, and at a word from Chetty Singh, Chawe took the seat directly behind him. Once they were settled, Chetty Singh passed the shotgun to the big Angoni. It was done as quickly and as neatly as an expert loader serving his gun in a Scottish grouse butt. Before Daniel could take any advantage, the double barrel was pressed firmly into the back of his neck, held there by Chawe. Chetty Singh stepped back to the open window beside Daniel.
"Chawe's English is absolutely atrocious, never mind," he said jovially, and then switched to the lingua franca of Africa. "When a Kaluma Funicolo, you speak like this?"
"Yes, I do speak Funicolo," Daniel agreed in the same language.
"Good, then you and Chawe will have no difficulty understanding each other. Just do as he orders, doctor. At that range, the shotgun will make a most unsightly mess of your coiffure, no doubt."
Chetty Singh stepped back, and at Chawe's command, Daniel reversed the Land Cruiser, swung it in a U-turn, and drove out through the main gates into the public road. In the rearview mirror, he saw Chetty Singh walk back to the green Cadillac and open the driver's door. Then the angle changed, and Daniel could no longer see into the warehouse. From the back seat, Chawe gave curt directions, emphasizing each with a jab of the shotgun muzzle into the back of Daniel's neck. They drove through the silent and deserted streets of the sleeping town, heading east towards the lake and the mountains. Once they were out into the country, Chawe urged him to increase speed, The road was good, and the Land Cruiser buzzed along merrily. By now, Daniel's wounded arm was stiff and painful. He nursed it on his lap, driving with one hand and trying to ignore the pain. Within an hour, the gradient changed, and the road began a series of hairpins as it climbed the first slopes of the mountain. On each side, the forest was denser and darker, pressing in upon the highway, and the Land Cruiser's speed bled off as she climbed. The dawn came on stealthily, and beyond the shafts of the headlights, Daniel saw the shapes of the forest trees emerging from the gloom. Soon he could see their high tops defined against the dawn sky. He turned his wrist and glanced at his watch. His sleeve was stiff with dried blood, but it was light enough now to read the dial clearly. 6:07. He had had plenty of time to consider his predicament, and to assess the man who held the gun to his head. He judged him to be a tough opponent. There was not the least doubt that he would kill without hesitation or compunction, and he handled the shotgun with a disheartening competence. On the other hand, it was an awkward weapon to use in the confines of the Land Cruiser's cab. Daniel considered his alternatives. He quickly discarded the idea of attacking Chawe in the truck. He would have his head blown off before he could turn to face him. He might kick open the side door and throw himself out of the cab, but that meant that he would have to reduce the Land Cruiser's speed below 50 to avoid serious injury when he hit the ground. Gradually, he lifted his foot from the accelerator. Almost immediately, Chawe sensed the change in the engine beat and thrust the shotgun into the nape of his neck. "Kowalesa, go faster!" That horse wouldn't run. Daniel grimaced and obeyed. On the other hand, Chawe wasn't likely to shoot him at this speed and risk the sudden loss of control and the inevitable pile-up. He expected an order to stop or pull off the road when they reached their destination, wherever that might be. That would be the time to make his play. Daniel settled down to wait until then. Suddenly the road was steeper and the bends sharper. The dawn was grey. As they came through each turn in the road, Daniel had glimpses of the valley below. It was filled with silver mist banks through which he made out the white cascades of a mountain river running deep in its gloomy gorge. Another bend loomed ahead, and he braced himself to negotiate it. Chawe spoke sharply. "Stop! Pull into the edge over there." Daniel braked and pulled over onto the verge. They were at the top of a cliff. The edge of the road was guarded by a line of white-painted rocks. Beyond that, the chasm gaped. It was a drop of 200 or 300 feet to the rocky riverbed below. Daniel pulled on the handbrake and felt his heart bounding against his ribcage. Would the shot come now, he wondered. It would be a stupid thing to do if they wanted to make it look like an accident. But then the big Angoni did not seem to be labouring under a heavy burden of brains. "Switch off the engine and give me the keys," he ordered. Daniel passed them over his shoulder. "Put your hands on your head," Chawe ordered. And Daniel felt a small lift of relief. He had a few seconds longer. He obeyed and waited. He heard the click of the door latch, but the pressure of the steel muzzle against his spine never slackened. He felt the cool draught of air as Chawe swung the back door open. "Do not move," he warned Daniel, and slid sideways from his seat, still aiming the shotgun in through the open door. Now he was standing alongside the car. "Open your door slowly." The shotgun was aimed through the side window into Daniel's face. He opened the door. "Now, come out." Daniel stepped down. Still covering him with the shotgun, holding it in one hand like a horse pistol, Chawe reached out with his left hand through the open door. Daniel saw that he had a steel jack-handle lying on the rear seat. During the journey, he must have taken it from under the front seat. In that instant, Daniel understood how Chawe planned to get rid of him. Chawe would prod him to the edge of the precipice with a shotgun, and then a single blow to the back of the skull with the jack-handle would tumble him 200 feet into the rocky gorge. After that, the Land Cruiser, with the driver's door open and probably with a burning rag stuffed into the filler of the fuel tank, would be pushed over the cliff on top of him. It would look like another tourist killed by negligent driving on a notorious stretch of mountain road.
Nothing to excite police suspicion or to tie the incident to Chetty Singh and a cargo of contraband ivory in Lilongwe, 100 miles from the scene. And at that moment, Daniel saw his opportunity. Chawe was reaching in through the open door, and he was just marginally off balance. Although the shotgun was still pointed at Daniel's guts, he would be slow to adjust his aim if Daniel moved quickly. Daniel hurled himself forward, not at the man or the gun, but at the door. He crashed into it with all his weight, and it slammed shut with Chawe's arm trapped between steel edge and jamb. Chawe screamed in agony. The sound of it did not cover the crack of breaking bone, sharp as a stick of dry kindling snapped across the knee. His forefinger, thick as a blood sausage, slipped across the trigger, firing one of the barrels. The blast of shot missed Daniel's head by a foot, though the detonation fluttered his hair and made him wince. The recoil threw the barrel high. Using his momentum, Daniel charged him head-on, seizing the shotgun with both hands at buttstock and hot barrel. Chawe's grip on the weapon was single-handed and weakened by the agony of broken bone trapped in the door. He fired the second barrel, but the shot flew harmlessly into the sky. Daniel slammed the side of the breech into his face, catching him across the upper lip, crushing his nose and shearing off all his upper teeth at the gum. Chawe bellowed through a mouthful of blood and broken teeth as he tried to pull his arm from the steel trap of the door. Daniel had the advantage of a double-handed grip on the shotgun and used it to tear the weapon from Chawe's right hand. He lifted the shotgun high, reversed it and drove the steel butt plate into Chawe's face, catching him in the side of the jaw with the full force of the blow. Chawe's jawbone shattered at the hinge and his face changed shape, sagging at one side as the bone collapsed. Stunned and uncoordinated, he fell backwards, held only by his trapped arm. Daniel yanked the door handle, and it flew open, releasing Chawe's arm when he was not expecting it. Chawe reeled backwards, not in control of his legs, windmilling his arms to try and retain his balance, the shattered arm flapping uselessly below the joint of the elbow. One of the whitewashed boulders at the edge of the cliff caught his heels, and he jerked backwards, as though plucked on a wire, and disappeared over the precipice. Daniel heard him scream. The sound receded swiftly as he fell, and was cut off abruptly on the rocks at the bottom. The silence afterwards was profound. Daniel found himself leaning against the Land Cruiser, with the shotgun still clutched to his chest, panting from those few seconds of wild exertion. He took a moment to gather himself, and then he went to the edge of the cliff and looked over. Chawe lay on his face on the rocks, at the edge of the waterfall, directly below. His limbs spread like a crucifix. There was no scuff mark at the brink of the precipice to mark his fall. Daniel thought swiftly. Report the attack? Tell the police about the ivory? Hell no. A white man had better not kill a black man in Africa, even in self-defense, even in a civilized state like Malawi. They would crucify him. His mind was made up by the sound of a heavy vehicle descending the mountain road in low gear. Swiftly, he slipped the shotgun onto the floorboards of the Land Cruiser and pulled a light tarpaulin over it. Then he crossed to the edge of the cliff, unzipped the fly of his trousers, and forced himself to urinate over the drop. The descending truck appeared around the bend of the road above him. It was a timber lorry piled with cut logs that were chained to the cargo bed. There were two black men in the cab, the driver and his assistant. Daniel made a show of shaking off the drops and zipping his fly closed. The black driver grinned and waved at him as the lorry rumbled past, and Daniel waved back. As soon as it was out of sight, he ran to the Land Cruiser and drove on up the mountain. Within 200 yards he found a disused logging track that branched off the main road. He drove through the dense secondary growth that clogged the track until he was out of sight of the road. He left the Land Cruiser there and went back on foot, ready to duck into cover at the sound of another vehicle. At the top of the cliff, he checked that Chawe's body still lay on the rocks below. His instinct was to leave him there and get far away from the scene as quickly as possible. He suspected that a Malawian prison was no great improvement on any other in Africa. His arm was very painful now as well.
He could feel the first fires of infection kindling, but he didn't want even to look at it until he had cleaned up the evidence against himself. He skirted the top of the cliff until he found a way down. It was a game path used by Hyrax and Clipspringer, steep and precarious. It took him 20 minutes to reach Chawi's body. The skin was cold as a reptile's when Daniel touched Chawi's throat. There was no need to check for a pulse. He was dead meat. Swiftly, Daniel turned out his pockets. He found that a greasy, well-thumbed passbook was the only piece of identification. He wanted to get rid of that. Apart from a filthy, tattered handkerchief and some loose coins, the only other items were 4 SSG shotgun cartridges and the key card for the control box of the electric door on the warehouse that Daniel had seen him operate. Well, that might come in useful. Satisfied that he had made it as difficult as he could for the police to identify the corpse, if they ever found it, Daniel rolled Chawe to the river edge, his broken arm flopping and catching under him, and shoved him into the racing water. He watched the body splash as it struck, then swirl and roll as it was carried swiftly downstream and disappeared around the next bend. He hoped that it would hang up on a snag somewhere in the inaccessible depths of the gorge, long enough for the crocodiles to get a decent meal, and further complicate the process of identification. By the time he had climbed back up the cliff and reached the Land Cruiser again, his arm felt as though it were on fire. Sitting at the driver's wheel with his medical box on the passenger seat beside him, he stripped back the torn, blood-caked sleeve and pulled a face at what he found beneath it. The claw wounds were not deep, but already they were weeping yellow, watery fluid, and the flesh around them was swollen a hot crimson. He packed the lacerations with thick yellow betadine paste and bandaged it. Then he filled a disposable syringe with a broad-spectrum antibiotic and shot it into the biceps of his own left arm. All this took time. It was almost 8 o'clock when he checked his wristwatch again. He reversed back down the logging trail and onto the main mountain road. He drove slowly past the top of the cliff, and the tracks of his tyres and the imprint of his feet showed clearly in the soft earth of the verge. He considered trying to obliterate them, and thought about the driver of the timber lorry who had seen him there. "Ah, I've hung around here long enough," he decided. "If I'm going to stop Chetty Singh, I've got to get back to Lilongwe." And he set off back towards the capital. As he drew closer to the urban areas, the traffic on the road was heavier. He drove sedately, avoiding drawing attention to himself. Many of the vehicles he passed were Land Rovers or Toyotas, so his truck was not remarkable. However, he regretted the touch of vanity that had led him to display his personal logo so prominently. "I never thought I'd make a fugitive from justice," he muttered. But still he knew that he could no longer parade around Lilongwe in the Land Cruiser. He drove to the airport and left the truck in the public car park. He took his spare toilet kit and a clean shirt from his sports grip and went to the men's washrooms in the airport building to clean up. He bundled his torn and blood-stained shirt and jersey and stuffed them into the refuse bin. Although it was still stiff and sore, he did not want to disturb the wound. After he had shaved, he dressed in a clean shirt whose long sleeves covered his bandaged arm. When he checked his image in the washroom mirror, he was reasonably respectable-looking, and he headed for the public telephone booths in the main concourse. A South African Airways flight from Johannesburg had just landed, and the concourse was crowded with tourists and their luggage. No one paid him any attention. The police emergency number was prominently displayed on the wall above the payphone. He disguised his voice by muffling it with a folded handkerchief over the mouthpiece and by speaking in Swahili. "I want to report a robbery and a murder," he told the female police operator. "Give me a senior officer urgently." "This is Inspector Mopola." The voice was deep and authoritative. "You have information of a murder?" "Listen carefully," Daniel told him, still in Swahili. "I'm only going to say this once. The ivory stolen from Chiwewe National Park is here in Lilongwe. At least 8 people were murdered during the robbery. The stolen goods are hidden in tea chests, which are being stored at the warehouses of the Chetty Singh Trading Company in the light industrial area. You had better hurry. They will be moved soon." "Who is speaking, please?" the inspector asked.
"That isn't important. Just get down there fast and get that ivory," Daniel told him, and hung up.